This is Youth Conference California 2013. Our speaker is Brother Jim Stiles. His topic for this series is Return of the Exiles. The title for this class is Mordecai, God's Faithful Leader. Brother Jim.
And we might even get a chance to look at Esther too, so that would be fine. The game plan right now is hopefully we will move into having a look at Esther, because I think when you look at chronologically, Esther will fit right into this sequence that we're looking at right now at the end of Ezra. So that you, when you're looking at sequentially, you have the book of Ezra and then the book of Esther, and then you have the story of Nehemiah. So we left off at the end of the first class this morning having a look at Ezra's approach. So how do you solve a problem, an ecclesial problem when it shows up, or a family issue when it shows up within a family? And so you, first of all, in chapter 9, you see that he publicly acknowledges that the issue's wrong. You don't try to cover it up and hide it, like the Benjamites did when they tried to, like, side with the man that had raped the concubine. So that's not the solution. So instead, you publicly acknowledge it, and you admit, we made mistakes. That's where you start. We all make mistakes, as James would say. You think about what you've done and the consequences of the mistakes. Well, you try to figure out, all right, now that we've done this, what are the long-term and the short-term consequences? And of course, with all the mistakes we make, we talk to God about them in prayer. We pray about them, and we ask for God's help and his wisdom in trying to come up with a solution, as Ezra did in verses 5 to 15. And then you consider some of the plans. I think this is fun to look at. Ezra doesn't come to the community and tell them about all the mistakes they've made and then say, here's what you got to do to fix it. Did you notice that? He doesn't do that. Ezra comes into this and he sits down with a bunch of people and says, we have a problem. And he prays about it and talks to the community. He talks to God. And then he, as sort of like a leader of your little project groups, he says, what do you think we should do? And the solution comes from within the community. I think that's a really interesting strategy when you're trying to solve problems. I just found that a lot of times in school, that was a much more useful strategy than having somebody come down all the time and tell everybody what to do. We used to find in our school that we would do that. We actually created a group of students that would be like the advisors to the teachers and the administrators. And when we had a problem in the school, we would talk to the kids and we'd say, here's the situation. We don't like what's happening in this case. What do you think we should do? And we ask for their opinion, and we look for what do you think is the solution. And many of the times, much to the surprise of many of the teachers and the administrators, the students would come up with very good solutions to try to implement. And I found that was really interesting to watch. And I think you can see the same thing in ecclesial life as well, or in families. And then what you do is you move forward, you know, to fix those problems, and you implement the plan, trusting that God will bless the pathway. And I really do think that as a group, we have to recognize the fact that when you get together in an ecclesia or a family and you talk out an issue and you come up with a solution, it doesn't have to be the one best right solution. It has to be a solution that you then pray that God will make it work, because otherwise we're afraid to do anything. We sit there all the time thinking about, well, what if you came up with the wrong idea? What if that's not the right one? What if we should have done something else? And we're always second guessing it. And so we move forward, we talk to God, we pray for his help, and then we watch how it's working out. And if it turns out that it's not solving the problem, then you go back to the drawing board and you try to rethink the case. And you'll see it's a very similar strategy, what Ezra uses right here. It's very similar to what Joshua did in solving the problem of the Gibeonites. I mean, what do you do when you've made a commitment to make a covenant with people that we were just told in Deuteronomy 7 in the first class, don't make any covenants with them? And then you went and did it. Now what do we do? And so now you got to try to figure out, well, how are we going to solve that? You know, and the simple solution was to just forget about the covenant, kill the Gibeonites, get rid of them. They lied to us anyways. You know, a lot of us would think that's the solution, honestly. I mean, when you're doing your readings and you read over that, I know that in here our brains work in such a way that that's the way we tend to think as people. They cheated. They lied. Forget about them. Kill them. And then we don't have the problem anymore. We were supposed to kill all the Gibeonites. That's not what they did. They let them live. And they figured, hey, there's no sense making another mistake on top of the first mistake. And they prayed God would bless the pathway. Do you know it's fun to watch? You know, some of those Gibeonites are still there working on the wall in Nehemiah's time. I find that's really interesting because it shows you God can bless pathways when we ask for his help that initially you might think that isn't the right way to go. And imagine the ecclesial discussion on that one. I wish I could have been at the arranging meeting Joshua was at that day and just watched everybody talk that issue out. What are we going to do with those Gibeonites? And then look at it hundreds of years later and find out, wow, God blessed that pathway. Some of those Gibeonite people came into the community and became examples to the Israelites. They were serious people. And not every one of them would have been, but some of them were. And they hung around after the captivity, and they're the people working on the wall. That's sort of fun to watch. Now, when you look at Ezra's prayer, you don't have time to go through the whole prayer this morning, but you look at how he starts out with humility. He confesses the sins that the community has committed. And he doesn't say your mistakes. He says our mistakes. He includes himself in part of the group. And he appreciates God's kindness and his mercy and how God had freed them to build God a temple. And he acknowledges their failures in verse 10 and that God had warned of the danger of not properly separating like this. And God had commanded separateness from the nations. And that he acknowledges God hasn't punished us as our sins deserve because he realizes the mercy of God. And that he seriously looks forward and understands that, look, if we don't correct these problems, it could lead to the destruction of the community. As Zechariah had said in those first few verses of chapter 1, that if we don't fix the problems of the past, we will end up going through the same thing our fathers did, and God could take us away into captivity again. And of course, he ends up with God is just, no one is righteous, and prays for God's help in finding a solution. And I do think it's fun to watch how Ezra worked this out. So it's fun to look at Ezra's sincerity. He really was serious about this. It wasn't just a club. It wasn't just like he's an ecclesial leader, so he treats it like a business and we have to find a solution. He's in there as one of them. He feels the problem and he's trying to find a solution. And because of his example, other people get drawn into finding the solution. So there they are before the house of God in Ezra chapter 10. And the people came, they prayed together, they looked for a solution, and prayed God would help them work through it. They wept bitterly in this case. They wept. Sometimes we look at our community and we think, well, you know, if guys cry, that's a sign of real weakness. We call them girls or something like that. You know, you see that happening. These people cared. They were serious. They didn't want their families and their friends to go and experience another captivity. So look who comes up with the solution. This reminds me so much of the divine council in 1 Kings 22 when Micaiah was called in with Ahab and he ends up telling Ahab, yeah, go ahead and fight at Ramoth-Gilead. You know, and Ahab comes in and says, Micaiah, come on, tell us, what did you really see? What did God really tell you? He says, well, here's what I really saw. I saw that there's a divine council, all the angels gathered with God. He brings a group of angels in and he talks about a situation. And God says to the angels, hey, here's the plan today. We got to make Ahab fall in Ramoth-Gilead. What do you think we should do? And this is what they did. They sat and had a council like that. Just the way the angels work with God. See, this is where you plan to become part of the heavenly host. And this is how it works. You don't come in with all the answers and force your will on everybody else that's there. This isn't how God's family works. You talk the issues out, you pray for God's help and his guidance, and you value the opinion of the people that you're working with, and you look for a solution. See, the best brainstorming groups that I've ever been in are the ones where everybody comes there with no preconceived idea about what we're going to end up with when we're done. It's not like I figured it all out and now I've got to get my idea across. But you come to the table, listen to everything, and then people just throw out ideas and you build on them. And then you come up with a solution that sometimes no one person ever even had figured out in the first place because it's a result of a group discussion. It's fun to see. So Shechaniah comes up with this solution in verse 2. Did you notice Shechaniah is involved? This isn't just somebody else forcing, like, you know, somebody else's problem. It's their families and all that. His dad, Jehiel, has a foreign wife in verse 26. So his dad had married one of these foreign women. Now, I don't know if he's necessarily one of the children of a foreign woman, but maybe his dad took on a second marriage and married one of the kids, and maybe he divorced his mom for all we know. We don't really understand. This is what Malachi said was going on, even amongst the leadership. So we find out that his dad has made this very mistake, and yet he's the one who presents, here's a possible solution. Maybe we should split them up. So the good news is there was hope. hope about God's mercy because they were willing to find a solution. Now, their solution is really interesting in relation to, you know, our situations today when you look at what they came up with. They had a brainstorming session, came up with an idea, and the solution is to divorce the foreign women. Divorce them. And, you know, sometimes in our community today, we would say, well, that can't possibly be right because all divorce is wrong. And that's a simple solution where you create a rule or you think that that's the way it works. That's not the solution they came up with. And I really don't think that it's fair to the text to actually come in and claim, as you'll find sometimes you're listening to Christadelphian talks, they'll try to tell you, well, they really weren't married to these women. That was just, they just lived with them, sort of like people do today in the world. And so they just put them away and they really weren't married. If you track the Hebrew words that are used there back into Deuteronomy 24, you'll find out that the same words are used in Deuteronomy 24 where divorce is brought up. So I think it's fairly safe to say that these people really were married and they really did divorce these women. That's part of the solution. So you look at the solution, and what they're trying to do is look to the future to how to save the community. And so everything's on the table. Everything's on the table as to what might be part of that solution. And their solution was, in this case, we don't want to go through what our fathers did. We don't want to end up in captivity again. We don't want to go down this pathway where we bring in foreigners and learn about their gods and we end up worshiping idols. So even though God hates divorce, their solution is that the best thing we can do at this time, when you rank all the possibilities, is to divorce these women, put away those foreign wives and their children, because they're looking to the future of their ecclesias. Now, that's hard to do for all of us. I mean, really, when you look at ecclesial life, it's very difficult for arranging brethren or for moms and dads to really put everything on the table and say, what's the best thing we can do? We're in a problem. We've got a situation that is a problem. Everything is a possibility, and you start ranking God's principles. And how are we going to find a solution to this? So they came up with a solution which was not a simple solution. This was not easy. This was not going to be easy to implement. And when they went to implement the solution, when they came up with this idea of let's make sure we separate from all the foreign women and their kids, the ones who are living as foreign women, the simple solution would have been to pass a rule, an ecclesial rule that just said, anybody who's married to a foreign woman, you must divorce your wife and your kids and put them all away. That's what rules are. We create a rule. I used to watch people in my school do this all the time. A problem would arise in school, an administrator would come along and just say, make a rule. Student leaves gum, you know, sitting there on the table. The next student comes in, sits on it, puts their hand on it. And teachers, they're so easy. It's that simple solution, nobody can chew gum. Doesn't that solve the problem? You don't have gum on the table then. And then you look around, is that really the solution you want to have? Every time we have a problem, you just make a rule and say, nope, nobody gets to do that. Now, they could have done that in this case. They could have passed a legislated rule that just said everybody married to a foreign woman is automatic divorce, put away the wives, and send them out of the community. But, you know, I don't think that's what they did when you look at the text and you study it. Because if that had been the case, how long would it take to do that? We could have passed the rule today, and we could have implemented that rule tomorrow. It might have taken time to actually split them up, but you could have implemented the rule tomorrow. What they did instead is they went through a process that took 3 months to look at the cases. And see, and this is what arranging brethren do. They look at people's situations. You have to get involved in a family. You have to test it out. They spend 3 months trying to figure out who needs to split up and who doesn't. So anyway, you look below the surface and read between the lines, it appears as though what they did is they brought in people who had married foreign women, and they'd bring them in and talk to them. And they'd talk to the fella, and they'd talk to the girl, and they'd say, all right, when you got married, what's your commitment to Yahweh, the God of Israel? And they would talk to the girls and find out, are you going to raise your children as a Hebrew, or are you going to raise your children as part of the old culture that you had? What do you intend to do? Are you going to teach them Hebrew? Are you going to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel? Or did you just join this community and you really have no intention to be a part of it? And it appears as though over 3 months, they went through all the possible cases and then categorized in the end a list of how many they found had to separate from their wives. This would have taken time to actually implement. I think, you know, when you look at the solution, it's very similar to what the Apostle Paul would have encouraged in the first century ecclesias. When people were coming into the community from the outside, and you had all these Gentiles pouring into the community, and we had this problem of what do you do with all these people that are coming into the community whose spouses have no interest in the Christadelphians, no interest whatever in worshiping the God of Israel. And so his solution was that he said in 1 Corinthians 7, in verse 12 there, that if an unbeliever is willing to stay, then give it a try. Pray about it. See whether you can work it out and try to win them over. Who knows? You know, maybe the unbeliever will be drawn to God. So you give it a try and watch, and you have to analyze, how is this going to go? But he goes on and says in verse 15 there of that chapter that if an unbeliever departs, if they don't want to be part of this community and they leave your marriage relationship, then let them go. For God has called us to peace. That's really interesting that that would be Paul's solution. And it only works in this case if the believer is really walking with God. He's not talking about people who are living in the world. He's talking about serious believers. And so that was Paul's solution at the time. So you look at the principles that Ezra is ranking. Now, we know that God has called us to be holy, for he is holy, that we really should separate ourselves to God. We have that divine principle that we're trying to uphold. We also know, on the other hand, that marriage is supposed to be for life. That's the divine principle. Marriage is for life. We're going to look at that in Malachi when we get there, that's what God wanted. He permitted divorce in Deuteronomy 24, but he permitted divorce for the hardness of their hearts. And I don't really think that's just a case of where he just permitted divorce and just said, well, a few people can divorce and it really, really don't want any divorce and so it shouldn't be in the community, which was true. God was practical and he understood the concept that families were going to break up. And so he said, if they're going to break up, God cared about all the girls. He didn't want the girls in the community left in a situation where you're raising children and you have nobody taking care of you. So he said, look, if you decide to divorce your wife, you give her a certificate of divorce so she is free from that relationship and she can find somebody else to take care of her. That's how practical our God is. He really does love you and he cares about your life. And although marriage was supposed to be for life, marriage is supposed to be, he also realizes, I've got to take care of these girls. I just can't leave you hanging out there with nobody to take care of you and your children. And that's how kind our God is. He's very practical that way. So he sets the divine ideal, but he also allows for the fact that we are not going to reach it at times because of the hardness of our hearts. And we also have that within the marriage relationship, another principle involved, that God wants the two of you to raise godly children. This isn't just about the two of you. This is about the future of God's ecclesia. He wants godly children. So that when Nehemiah comes along and the people can't even speak Hebrew, we've got a problem. And this is what Malachi would bring up, and he's going to talk about. The goal is raising godly children. That's the goal. That's one of the principles that we're trying to sustain. So if you look at those principles and you realize that, wow, some of these people, they've married to the outsiders. Those people, they're not even raising their children to know about Yahweh, the God of Israel. We can't, principle number three is God. That one's hopeless. We've already lost that if this is the case. And then you go to principle number one. What are you going to do? We're supposed to be holy. And these people aren't upholding principle number one, that holiness, separateness to Yahweh our God. And so you look and you rank the principles and you come up with a solution that tries to match the principles. And although marriage is supposed to be for life, there are times in the Bible where that principle is not the top one. Even though we sometimes present it as it is. It isn't in God's standards. You'll see a number of times where that is not the top issue. It's more important that holiness is there, separateness is there, and raising godly children was a key item at this time. So that's the challenge that every set of parents, you will deal with someday if Christ stays away. When you have children, you have to rank the principles all the time and have to make decisions based upon which are the most important. And that's what arranging brethren have to do. And this is what sisters do in ecclesial life as well. So you go back and look at, there were other examples of this in the Old Testament. This wasn't the first time. You go back and look at when they first came out of Egypt and they came to Mount Sinai, God said right away, I know what you guys think about slavery. You've been slaves in Egypt. But when you have slaves, you're not going to treat them the way the Egyptians treated you. And right away he gave the rules about slavery. And so when he ranked the rules about slavery, if I had a slave, or if say I was a slave, so I was somebody's slave, and I found a woman that I cared about, my Aunt Sue, and we get married, and she's a slave. When my time comes up to where I am free, we would tend to think that if I'm married to Aunt Sue, that that marriage should have been above slavery. And it isn't in God's eyes. He put the rules about slavery, about master-slave ownership, he ranked those higher than marriage. And ahead of time you think, what? Why? Why would he do that? Because he wants them to know you've just been redeemed from Egypt to become slaves of God, and that's the number one principle. And so if I decide to go free and Aunt Sue's not free over there, then my marriage breaks up at that point because I can't take her out with me. It's just interesting to watch how God ranks rules. And you can do that when you're going through the law sometime. Just watch how he ranks the rules. And in this case, the marriage to the ungodly believers who brought in these practices into the family, you find in Ezra and Nehemiah, he figures that godliness and about raising godly children, those things are a higher principle than the marriage relationship. And it's time to break those up because they're not working anyways. Those marriages, they're not working. So why would you sustain something that's already a lost cause and is causing all this trouble in the community? Or you look at, in the case of 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul says that God has called us to peace. And you know, if you think in the kingdom age, that when Christ returns and sets up the kingdom and all the world is going to be at peace, and you think all those problems are going to go away, you might be surprised to find that the mortals in the kingdom are going to have the same problems that we do today. And so you'll find out that the rules in the kingdom were that the Levites in Ezekiel, the Levites are not allowed to marry a divorced woman. And therefore, that tells us there must be divorced people even in God's kingdom. It's not like human nature is going to change. The mortal people are still going to have these problems. And we're still going to have to help them work through this. And that's what you find in Bible concepts. So as a person, how would you rank the conflicts? How would you, if you were looking at issues where laws of God conflict, what do you do? We tend to like, sometimes you read the Bible, you don't even realize this is happening. But sometimes God's laws conflict with one another, and you have to then rank them as to which one is most important. You have to make a choice. So God gave them the law of keeping the Sabbath. He also gave them the law of circumcising your child on the eighth day. What happens if the eighth day is the Sabbath? What do you do? What do you do? Do you circumcise or do you keep the Sabbath? See, some of you probably never even thought about that before, but there are conflictions in the law. And then you have to rank them and try to figure out what are you going to do? What do you do when the priest's job was to go in every day and keep the lamps full of oil and switch the bread up at time, and they went into the holy place and they would do this. What happens if it's a Sabbath day where God says you're not supposed to do any work? Are they allowed to do that on the Sabbath day? Which one's more important? And see, to the Jews, they just took all these rules and made it to their convenience. But that's not what Christ did. Christ actually says you have to follow the principles. You got to rank them. So what do you do? So David comes up to the tabernacle, and he's got these men with him who are starving. They've been out with him, and they're hungry. What do you do when you have a law that says to feed the hungry? And at the same time, you got these rules in the tabernacle about the showbread. Only the priests were allowed to eat the showbread. What do you do? That's why Jesus would bring these up and say, don't you realize, you Jews, you legalists who keep your law to your advantage, don't you realize what David did when his men were hungry? How they went in and asked for the showbread and they ate that which was not lawful for them to eat? You have to rank the principles in life. It's not so simple as just get out a rule book and follow the rules. It doesn't work like that. And it won't be like that when we join the angels in the kingdom either. We are going to have to rank things and make decisions all the time. And God's trying to train us to do that now. So what do you do when you have a principle of marriage for life, and you have, on the other hand, holiness to God and separateness to God and raising godly children? What are you going to do when you have to rank those principles? And it's all falling apart, and they're not working. Well, you look at the Gibeonites. You can do the same thing with them. What do you do? The Gibeonites, God told us to kill them. They're supposed to die. But now we've made a covenant with them. So what do you do? Do you put faithfulness to a covenant above killing the Gibeonites? How do you rank those? Then look at how people did that in the Bible. And really, it's really interesting to watch how Jesus ranked those things, how he did that. I find that really fascinating that he would go through issues like that and rank some of these principles. Remember when that woman was taken in adultery and everybody knew it in John 8 and they brought him out in front of there and said, now what are you going to do? We got this woman caught in adultery and we have witnesses. All right. According to the law, what should have happened to her? What did the rule book say? Stone her. That's the rules. And Jesus looks around and he probably wrote stuff in the ground that made all of them think about their own mistakes. He wrote in the ground. And one by one, they all take off and they leave. He didn't stone her. He said, go your way and sin no more. And yet we would all think that if Jesus was following the law, he should have said, stone her. I think that's a real warning to all of us that we got to be careful when we read the law in the Old Testament. See, when God gave the law, what he gave is, here's what you deserve. Here's what should happen to you because of your sin. But you know what's missing in the law? You ever notice this when you read God's law in the Old Testament? What is totally missing that we all want? Mercy. Because the assumption was that you would all know that we all want mercy. We've all broken those laws. We all need mercy. And therefore, who has to write a rule about mercy? It should be that everybody understands that we should be willing to extend mercy to people who make mistakes, who seriously come to us and say, I goofed, I'm sorry. And we're not talking about people that are working against us, so that's different. But if somebody, like the guy who blasphemed God on the Sabbath like that, that guy didn't care. Or when he blasphemed the name of God, he wasn't looking for some kind of salvation. He just thought he could do it. And that's different than people that are sorry. And so what you have to do then, young people, is rank those laws. And in this case, when they weighed out the issues, they came up with a solution that said, all right, the primary problem here is that we're married to unbelievers, our kids aren't going to grow up faithful to God, our future is at stake, and in this case, they figured divorce was a secondary problem. As much as God hates divorce, that wasn't, in this case, the primary problem. And so their solution is divorce those women and put them away. And this is what we all do through, we all go through in our own lives, I think. When you look in the New Testament, you see Paul was dealing with these same issues. What do you do when you're baptized into Christ and you're a Gentile, and now you're freed from all of this law, or you're a Jew, now you realize you're freed from the law, and now you're sitting there at the table with somebody, and you're having a meal with them, and somebody just says, well, you know, that roast beef you're eating right there, that was offered to an idol in the temple this morning. What do you do? Because you're supposed to have the freedom to eat that meat. And then that person sitting there with you, maybe they're a Jew and they haven't been allowed to do that all their life. What are you going to do? Are you going to encourage somebody to transgress their conscience and to go against their conscience? Or are you going to decide at that point, all right, I won't eat it either? Yeah. And this is what happened in the New Testament. They had to rank the rules. The rules book isn't the solution. It's how you implement the rule book that God cares about. That's what he's looking to see. So we have all these liberties that we have that we can exercise in Christ. But Paul's point is that when you exercise those liberties, make sure you realize that you're doing it through love and that you're serving one another. So that's what happens. You can either carry out the judgments and you can be one of those people that just says, you broke the rule, therefore you get this. Or you can be somebody who takes the time to talk to people, find out what's happening in their life, why did this occur, how do you feel about it, are you sorry for what you've done, and try to figure out where do we go from here. And God's mercy has always been available. Just think about yourselves. I mean, every day you appeal to God for his mercy. Every day we make mistakes, and God could kill us, and he doesn't, because he loves his children. He loves those that are trying to follow him. And so mercy is what God holds out for people. That's what he does. And it's fun to watch that. So the choices that we make, though, and you go back and you start to implement this in your family, in your home, in your ecclesia, the choices that you make about these issues are going to reveal the understanding that you have about God's character in terms of, like, are you living like God? Are you following what God does? And he gives us the hints in the scriptures. Or are we just reading the rule books and implementing the rules? So they implement the solution. They come up with Shechaniah's idea. They say, this is it. We're going to do it. And they go out and they tell each other, be strong and courageous. Let's go do it. And so Ezra makes them swear an oath. This is what we're going to do. Just like they had in the days of other kings that they had gone through in before. Nehemiah does it again later on. And you find out within 3 days, everybody had to come in within 3 days. So they had 3 days to show up. And then they spend 3 months trying to figure out who's a solution, who's part of this, who do we have to make break up from their wives and their kids, and who can we work with? And that's what they did. And so they go through this, and they start working this out over this period of time. Now, look at the result. It's interesting to watch what happened in the end. The result of this whole problem is, in the end, that only 113 men are forced to divorce their wives. 113 in a community of, what, over 40,000 men. 113 cases. You go back and look at the list. Ezra actually tells us in this case. There's no mention anywhere of women marrying foreign men. It was always the problem of the guys marrying the girls. That seems to be the problem. So you get 113 men. Four of them out of 113 were from the high priest family. That's pretty sad. There were 13 other priests and 10 Levites. No wonder Ezra was concerned. This problem is coming in from the leadership down. It wasn't just 113 cases in the community. Out of those 113 cases, what, 27 of them? 27, a fourth of them were in the leadership of the community. And then there were 86 common Israelites. So it indicates that the problem really wasn't all that widespread amongst Israelites in the end, unless somebody had exaggerated the problem. You're looking at a pretty low percentage. Only 0.3% of the men in this case had married foreign women. You look around our community today, we have a lot higher percentage than that. And only 0.3%. But 27 priests and Levites. Ooh, that's something to be concerned about when your leadership is setting that kind of an example. So you look at Ezra's success, like why this worked for the community right then. Not that it worked in the long haul, because Nehemiah has to deal with it again. But it solved the current problem right then and gave them a pathway to move forward. So you admit the problem exists. You identify with the people and say, I'm part of the problem and I will help you be part of the solution. You pray to God for help because you're looking for his guidance. When Shechaniah comes up with an idea, and people do that in our ecclesias, they come up with an idea, that's angels working in our midst, giving us ideas to work with. And you let the people develop the solution. You don't mandate what everybody else has to do from me. You let the people that are working on this, come up with a solution, talk it out, and come up with a joint solution that we can all agree to implement. And get most of the people to agree with it. You won't ever get everybody. You won't get them all. But you'll get most in this case. And that seems to be what they found. And then take the time to talk to people. Examine cases individually. I'm sure there were Jewish men married to foreign women that this was a decision time for their family. What are you going to do? And women would have to make a decision. Imagine you girls. You're either going to have to decide to join the community, or you're going to have to walk away from your husband with your kids, and you're gone. You're separate from the camp. And probably at this time, some of them were forced to make some pretty big decisions at this time. And that's what we do. We help people make those decisions. And that's what you find happening at this time. So that's really the end of Ezra. And yeah, that's your little reminder. Justin wanted to make sure everybody realizes this snack table is still over there, available for all of those that would like to avail themselves of snacks. And with that, we are going to move on. So the game plan today, the second part of it at least, was to have a look at Esther, the story of Esther. Because at the end of your workbook, I think you found that the period of Esther fits in right now, Esther and Mordecai. So where are we at on the timeline? So those of you that are working on the timeline, you can see that when you get into the period of Esther right in here, here's where Vashti got disposed right there, probably around the, somewhere around the third year of Darius Hystaspes. And Esther comes in and she's made queen right in this period here. So the story of Esther takes place somewhere in that period right in there. All right, that's where we are in the timeline. Now, when you look in the book of Esther and you wonder, like, how do people know that? The very first few verses tell us. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. So here we have that name again, Ahasuerus. And it's just a general title. So then the writer of Esther gives you a few more details so you know which Ahasuerus is this. Is this the one back in Ezra 4 that we're talking about, or is it a different fellow? And I think you'll see it's a different fellow in this case because he says it's the Ahasuerus who reigned in this case over 127 provinces from India over there all the way over to Ethiopia, right? This is this fellow here. He had this huge Persian kingdom at this point. This is when the Persian kingdom was at its greatest. And when he sat on his throne, which was in Shushan the citadel, in that third year of his reign, he makes a feast and tells you this whole incident. And you remember the story. It's a great Sunday school story about the time with Vashti. So this fellow reigned over the Persian Empire over that whole period right there. And we know that not many Persian kings really had the whole empire. Yes. What part of the statue? Oh, you mean like Nebuchadnezzar's image thing? So where we would be in Nebuchadnezzar's image, it starts out with the Babylonian king, you know, the Babylonian head, and then you move down into the Medo-Persians, right? So we're in the Medo-Persian. We're in the breast and the arms period. It appears as though when they first took over that there was a Mede, a fellow called Darius in Daniel. He was Darius the Mede, and he was lined up with the Persians, which may be why you've got the two arms. And when they first conquered the Babylonians, that they sort of jointly reigned for a little while there, but eventually Cyrus took over pretty quick, and Cyrus became the key leader of the Medo-Persian Empire, and then that's what we know as Cyrus. Cyrus too, Cyrus the Great. He's the one who made the decree for the Jews to come back. So it's fun to see that Esther and Mordecai, they are related. Now, when you ask a lot of people, you know, how they're related, a lot of people think that Mordecai was Esther's uncle. That's interesting, one of those Bible trivia events. You just ask people, how are they related? And a lot of people, for some reason, I think it's maybe because it uses the word uncle in there in our text. But actually, Mordecai and Esther were actually cousins. They really weren't uncles. As you can see up on the chart right there, that they both really come from the same line right in here, whereas Mordecai came from Jair and she came from Abihail. They both were grandchildren of the same dad. So they actually were cousins, not really uncles. It says there in verse 7 that Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. And maybe that's why we remember it as an uncle. Maybe. It's a possibility. So when you look at the timeline of the kings then, you try to figure out, all right, where are we in the kings? I think some of you probably found out that the book of Esther starts probably around the third year right there. Around the third year, and that's probably when Vashti was deposed, in about the third year of Darius Hystaspes. And then it moves on through, and it goes through a number of years after that. Haman comes along in the 12th year. So we're from the third year, 12th year, somewhere in that period there in the reign of Darius Hystaspes. When you look at the purpose of the story of Esther as to why we even have this, the story of Esther, it shows how God was in control, even when things seemed out of control. And it shows that he will be faithful to his promises. He said that he would do this for them, and he did. He kept his promise. It also demonstrates God's providence. I like the book from that perspective because it shows you how God was so actively working in a period of time when it doesn't talk about angels, doesn't say anything about angels in the book, that God's name isn't even mentioned in the book. And certainly it would have motivated these Jewish captives in Babylon to think about going back to the land, which is what the prophets were trying to do. Zechariah 2. You're looking at the call was going out. They're back in the land. We have permission. The temple's finished. Ezra's gone back. Let's get back to the land of Israel. And at the same time, it illustrates very clearly how God was at war with Amalek from generation to generation, that God will deal with sin. And so the story really helps out a bit that way. Now, when you look at some of the life lessons that come out of the story of Esther, you certainly see God's providence. He is in control and he's working. You see the preparation issues that are there, how Esther prepared to meet the king. You see the obedience concept between Mordecai and Esther. That's really, it's actually emphasized in this book, trying to teach us about obedience, not just to a cousin, but our obedience to God and faithfulness to him. You look at faith operating in these people where they made some decisions and Esther takes a deep breath and goes in before the king, not knowing if it's going to cost her life in order to save her people. Or witnessing, it actually comes up in this story, because as a result of all the things that happened in this book, many Gentiles came in and became associated with the Jews and grabbed the whole of a Jew. I think that's Zechariah 10 there, that many Gentiles will grab hold, 10 men will grab hold of the robe of a Jew. You see that in a foreshadowing back here. Or God's war with Amalek is there as well, and get out of Babylon before it's too late. So this was recorded for us. Look at the examples in this book of God's providence, where God was working through angels in a way in which you had to have an eye of faith to see it. In chapter 2, remember the story. These are good Sunday school stories. You remember how Mordecai just happened to hear about the plan of Bigthana and Teresh to hurt the king? Oh yeah, just happened to hear about it. So he tells, it's taken care of. And did you notice? It just happened to be recorded in the Chronicles of the Kings, sort of like Cyrus's decree. So that later on when the king can't sleep at night and he reads through the records and, oh yeah, what have we done for Mordecai? Isn't that, and see, this is what angels do in your life. They bring about these events so the right things will happen. In chapter 4, at verse 13, Mordecai understood deliverance would arise to save the Jews. He understood that very clearly. And he says to Esther, you may have come to the kingdom at this time so you can influence the king. And there's this case in chapter 6 where the king couldn't sleep. And so he reads about what Mordecai has done and totally turns around what Haman was thinking at that time. And look at the God's providence where Haman has the gallows made, thinking he's going to hang Mordecai. And in the end, the angels totally turn it around and Haman gets hung on his own gallows. It's sort of fun to watch all those things. Or the case of where Haman thinks he's going to be honored by the king. And what a turn of events where Amalek, in this case, has to honor Mordecai, take him through the streets, and tell everybody to honor Mordecai. It's just fun to watch how God's providence was operating at this case in the story of Esther. I can't remember. Are we done at 12? Is that right? 12 o'clock? So I think I'll just leave it at that then for this morning. You know, that'll give us at least some background on Esther. Maybe we'll pick it up again later on at some point tomorrow. But the game plan tomorrow will be to have a look at a bit of Nehemiah and also some of Malachi. And hopefully that will finish off our studies for this week. So we'll leave it at that. And hopefully we will all enjoy our lunch and all the fun activities for this afternoon. Yeah.